Goro said. If we had not meddled in interstellar affairs, he would be with us even now.
It was Lord Hesho's decision to answer the Superiority's call, Kaori said. Do you question his will?
Goro sputtered. No, but... Kaori continued as if Goro hadn't interrupted her.
The Delver immediately turned on Winzik's own people, but still he persists. He offered us a path to primary citizenship, but we were only pawns, meant to enact his violence for him. If we don't begin to forge alliances, we will stand alone when the destruction comes.
This is fear-mongering, Goro said. The humans are the real threat. Kaori replied, and the two of them went on, arguing back and forth. Juno, the Kitsun lore keeper, sat in the front row near my feet. I leaned forward and whispered to him, Is it always like this? Juno leaned toward me. No, he said. Our Senate is young. Before we lost our king, he made the decisions, instructing our people how to vote. It was easier then for us to arrive at decisions. Our wills were aligned, and we had unity. Alanique bristled a little at the wording, but I saw his point. That was the way the DDF worked. Our admiral made the decisions, and the rest of us carried them out. We could act quickly that way, and decisively. But it also meant we could swiftly make the wrong decision, if the person at the top made the wrong call. I thought about what Arturo said, that our lives were easier when we could think about things simply. We had to kill the Krell because they were trying to kill us. There was no moral ambiguity, no diplomacy to navigate. I supposed, after a fashion, my parents had been doing something brave, trying to pioneer a new way. In other circumstances, they might have been heroes. Goro looked ruffled, like he felt he was starting to lose the argument. We must settle this matter decisively, he said. Allow my champion to fight a champion of the human's choosing. Our might will decide the victor. He seemed to have only that one argument, and I noticed no one in the Senate had brought a champion with a sword. We hadn't seen anyone else dressed like Goro in the city either. He was the only one insisting that a trial by combat was a reasonable course of action.
The humans have already said they mean us no harm, Kaori said. They don't want to fight with us. A physical fight between Kitsun and Giant would only cause unnecessary pain.
To them, maybe, Goro said. My champion will fell the giant like our heroes of old. They will not stand before the blades of... Yeah, his argument was starting to reach the fever pitch of someone who knew they were losing. But the Senate members hadn't given their opinions yet, so why would he be? Goro looked over at me and seemed confused. Was he trying to bait us into fighting him? That would certainly make his argument easier. Kaori followed his gaze and I raised a hand, indicating that I wanted to speak.
For my next argument, Kaori announced, I would like to introduce the witness testimony of Flight Leader Waite.
Goro hunched a bit, looking disgruntled.
Jorgen,
FM whispered,
what are you doing?
Trying something, I said. This is preposterous, Goro mumbled. A human should not speak to the Senate.
Kaori is allowed to enter the testimony of another to make her argument for her, Adi said imperiously. Flight Leader Waite, you may speak.
Stars, I wished I was more prepared for this. I'd have preferred to have FM do it, but there wasn't time. She was right. If we gave even the slightest indication that we would participate in Goro's duel, we solidified their already terrible preconceptions of us. On behalf of my people, I said, I'm sorry for what you've suffered at human hands, but we aren't interested in fighting you. They arrived with destructors on their ships, Goro said, and they expect us to believe.
You will wait your turn,
Adi admonished him. And Goro snarled a bit, but shut his mouth. Our destructors are used in defense, I said, of ourselves and of our allies. And we would very much like you to be our allies. Goro's furry little brow bunched, and his champion leaned over and whispered something to him, though Goro waved her off. Kaori gave a triumphant little smile.
I rest,
she said, and she nodded to me. Goro had been trying to bait us into something, and if we'd risen to the bait and fought his champion, we would have proven everyone right about us. Goro clearly wanted that. Was it because our presence weakened his power, or did he think he was doing his people a favor by trying to reveal our true intentions?
Very well, Audie said. The argument is over. We will now hear from the Senate.
Kaori turned around and raised her fist at me, in a gesture I was coming to recognize as both a greeting and approval. Goro floated closer, his champion standing beside him with her gauntleted arms crossed.
I don't know what your game is, human, he grumbled.
I don't have a game, I said, except to bring our people home, make peace with you, and coordinate a resistance against the superiority. Goro narrowed his beady little eyes at me.
Your people never looked at us as allies before.
And I'm sorry for that, I told him. But we aren't them. We're concerned about your welfare, and the welfare of all the species the superiority claims are lesser. I looked over at FM and she nodded her approval. Stars, maybe I was getting some of this right at least.
Hmm,
Goro said, crossing his arms to mirror his champion.
Well, we will see.
Paws waved in the air all around the room, and Audie floated her microphone over to them, allowing the senators to speak. The first few senators focused on Goro's argument, his right to challenge newcomers to a trial by combat. Several felt there was no harm in granting his request, though they all seemed to regard it as odd, and suggested we should be obliged to appoint a champion or leave the planet in disgrace. The Kitsun with the rings in his ears said that Goro had no authority over Dreamspring or the surrounding island, so his challenge was invalid. Goro would need to wait and reissue it if one of us set foot on his island, which had another long name I didn't quite follow. Stars, it was getting hot in here. We were inside the rock, where it should have been cooler, but the heat of so many bodies in one place was starting to make the room humid and stuffy. I looked over at FM, who was listening to the Kitsun speak with obvious and growing concern. This isn't going well, she said to me. She was right. Instead of focusing on what I'd said about peace, the conversation was getting bogged down in the disputed legality of Goro's request. And in between, senators began to comment on the bigger issue. Dare they defy the superiority by working with us? That would mean throwing away all their progress toward primary citizenship. They gave up their monarchy for that, which they all seemed to consider a great sacrifice.
Lord Hesho gave his life to try to further our cause with the superiority, one of the Kitsun with a notched ear said. How can we dishonor his sacrifice by abandoning his quest?
Kaori squirmed like she dearly wanted to argue with that, but both she and Goro remained silent, which I gathered was the rule. We had not been given permission to speak again, and we hadn't interrupted. I simultaneously wished someone would ask our opinion and was unsure of what I would say. If Spencer were here, she'd say something. She wouldn't be able to sit here and listen to this without telling them how wrong they were. She wouldn't worry about finding the right words. She'd trample forward on Moxie alone, and it would work. Because Spencer was amazing like that. And somehow she had confidence in me. Stars, I could have used a little of that confidence right now. I let my mind slip into the nowhere, searching for her. Alanique was sitting right here, and while I didn't hear her in the nowhere, I also didn't want her to open her mind and hear me, so I stayed quiet, looking, listening. The Kitsun senators continued to argue, but I caught only snatches.
Superiority has the power. Who are these humans that they think they can win?
The nowhere was quiet as ever, devoid even of that strange raised texture I'd encountered on Platform Prime. There was something, though, there in the emptiness. Not Spencer, but an image of her. She was cleaning a part from a starfighter. I couldn't see the area around her, but I could see her and could sense her loneliness, and a feeling of concern for her that wasn't mine. It came from the image, from the nowhere.
Stars. Was the Nowhere concerned about Spensa? It was only a strange place. It couldn't think or feel. Could it? The Kitson went on, the arguments getting more heated as they went.
Threaten our way of life. We shouldn't be working with any of them unless we want...
The image of Spensa faded. It hadn't seemed like it came from Spensa herself, but I had no idea where or who it had come from. It was gone now, and I couldn't find it again.
Destruction for us and all our kin, if we aren't careful.
An image welled up in my mind. The superiority ship where my parents died, cut to ribbons and expanding ever outward against the blackness of space. I shoved it down, reaching through the Nowhere again. Spensa was in here somewhere. I'd found that image. I should be able to find her. Even if we couldn't talk, I wanted to know she was there. That vibration I'd felt before grew stronger, a cytonic resonance from somewhere on the island. And then, loud in my mind, a voice cried, "Help us!" And I visibly startled. Other than Juno, who looked up at me in alarm, the other Kitson didn't seem to notice. Both FM and Alinique did, though, and they turned to me.
"Are you okay?"
Alinique asked. "Fine," I said. I drew back into myself. That voice. It had come from the Nowhere, but it wasn't Spensa. I didn't know who it was. Maybe Gran-Gran? But she was here on Evershore, not in the Nowhere.
Scud, why was it so hot in here?
Sandstone walls felt like they were closing in on me. I wanted to escape, but I couldn't slip out. I'd have to crawl through the scudding doorway on my hands and knees again. What kind of message would that send? I tried to focus on the words of the senator who was speaking, a very large Kitson with brown tufts at the ends of his ears.
"If our most honored one who was not king were here, he would surely agree that..."
"Do not profane the name of the one who was not king," another interrupted. "In his wisdom, he would surely have said..."
Stars. They all seemed to have an opinion of what their not king would do if he hadn't died in the battle with the Delver. Did we kill him? We very well might have. And when they invoked his name, they sounded uncomfortably like me, trying to convince Vice Admiral Stoff of what Cobb would do if he were here. Stars, was this what I sounded like? Like I was merely trying to win a scudding argument, making the specter of Cobb agree with whatever I said?
"Jorgen,"
Alinique said again,
"are you okay?"
"I'm fine," I said, and I cringed, glad FM couldn't hear me. "You aren't fine," she'd said. "You can't be fine." She knew. Stars. Everyone probably knew. I was trying to hold everything together, but it was all slipping through my fingers and... "Help us," the voice in the Nowhere said again. Stars. It didn't sound like Gran-Gran. Who was that? Didn't they know I couldn't help anyone? Not my flight, not even my parents?
"Our lives are stable here," a graying Kitson said. His skin was loose around his face, and he carried a small cane that he leaned on while he sat. "Why would we risk angering the superiority? We should be working with them, or we will end up hunted like the humans have been, and we will have no one to blame but ourselves."
Damn it. The Kitson might have easier lives than we did. They might be able to choose to go play on the beach in the afternoon, or have feasts, or duel each other needlessly because they were squabbling and bored. But if it drove them to that kind of thinking, then it was a luxury that bred carelessness. My parents had wanted that kind of luxury for me, for us, and they'd reached for it. And that was why they were dead. I saw my mother's face behind the glass, resigned to her fate.
"Do better than we did."
But we weren't doing better. We were having the same damn argument again.
"Help us,"
the voice said from the Nowhere. No, voice says. There were many of them. Maybe they weren't real. Maybe it was my own mind conjuring up all the people I was failing. Cobb and my flight and all the people on Detritus who were going to die because I didn't know what I was doing. "I can't do better," I thought to my mother. She couldn't hear me. She wasn't here with us. She wasn't in the nowhere. She wasn't anywhere. She was gone. And soon the rest of us would be too, and it would be all my fault. I tried to take a deep breath, but I couldn't. The room was stifling, and the walls were closing in, and that superiority ship exploded and contracted again and again in my mind, the bits of debris flying outward into the void. There was a hollowness in my chest where my soul used to be, where the part of me that loved my parents, that cared and felt, had been kept. Now it was nothing but emptiness. And for the first time, I was glad Spensa wasn't here. I didn't want her to know. I didn't want her to see. The shame of it all coiled inside me and then exploded outward like the superiority ship. Boom. Bits of the nowhere ripped through my mind, coalescing into physical waves and bursting out like shrapnel from a bomb. The explosion caught the platforms on which Kaori and Goro were hovering and pitched them to the side, dumping the kits into the floor. Audie's cup tilted wildly, bits of the sides chipping off. The force of it knocked several of the kitsen in the front rows back in their seats. Alanique grabbed me by the arm. She seemed unharmed, but what just happened? Snuggles and Boomslug suddenly appeared at my feet. "Boom," Boomslug said. The senators were all staring at me, and many of them began to talk at once. The pin couldn't parse what they were all saying, but I gathered that not one of them was happy with me.
"What the scud was that?" FM asked. "Mind blades," Alanique said. "Jorgen, how did you—"
"I didn't mean to," I said. "I didn't mean to." "Saints and stars. I'd just been talking about peace, and now I did this in the middle of a diplomatic meeting?"
"Boom," Boomslug said again, and he started to nuzzle my ankle as if in sympathy.
He hadn't done this. He and Snuggles had felt it through the nowhere and had come to comfort me. I'd somehow manifested mind blades in the middle of a room full of scudding diplomats, and now,
"Order," Audie called. "The house will come to order."
Goro regarded me with satisfaction.
"Now you see,"
he bellowed from the floor, close enough that the pin managed to pick him up.
"The humans speak only the language of violence. It is the only means they'll respond to."
I couldn't catch all of it, but several of the kitsen raised their fists in that gesture of solidarity. Stars, I'd ruined everything.
"That's not true," I said.
It came out louder than I wanted it to, my voice overpowering Audie's as she called for order.
"That's not true," I said again, and the senators began to quiet.
Several of them had scrambled over the backs of their seats to use them as shields. "We're not here to hurt you," I said. "We only want you to understand that we have tools to fight the superiority. It is possible for us to beat them, but only if we work together." That was a lie on two fronts. I hadn't done that on purpose as a display of power, and I didn't know if we really had the power to defeat the superiority, even together. But saints and stars, I was in it now.
"I understand. It's a lot to ask for you to side against the superiority. I know they have better ships and better technology. That's been true since long before I was born, and my people have been successfully resisting them for 80 years. We don't know anything about you or your culture, but we know about them, because we have fought them and we have survived. We don't want what happened to us to happen to anyone else. We don't want anyone else to be hunted, to have to live in hiding, to be killed in droves every time you so much as stick your heads out of the ground." The kitsen's eyes widened as they watched me, and several of them laid their ears back in what I thought might be fear. I didn't know if it was still me they were afraid of, or the superiority, but I'd made this mess. I'd insisted on coming here. I'd scudding lost control in the middle of the most important diplomatic meeting I'd ever been in, and stars, I had to fix it. "You may feel like you have peace and prosperity here, but Kaori is right. The superiority is trying to make a deal with the Delvers, and they're going to come for anyone who opposes them. This might be our last chance to resist before they have the power they need to control every planet in the galaxy. How long do you think your planet will last without allies?
FM put a hand on my arm and I startled. Scud, was I messing this up? But beside me, she smiled and nodded.
Keep going, Alanique said in my mind. You have to convince them.
The Kitson watched me in shock, but not one of them had complained yet that I was speaking out of turn. I didn't know if I could convince them, especially after what I'd just done. Stars, what had I done? But I had to try.
We tried to reason with the superiority, I said. They offered us a treaty, and we sent a delegation to sign the deal.
My throat closed, but I spoke through it.
The superiority offered us peace, and then locked our leaders up in a ship and blew it to pieces. Half our government is gone. I will not fight you, because I have had enough of senseless violence and death. If you want, we will collect our people and go. But before we do, I want to offer you the opportunity to join us. The Urdale already have. The superiority made a deal with the Urdale, and then visited their planet with a battleship bent on destroying them. This new superiority government, that's what they do. And if you try to reason with them, they're going to come for you too. And I don't want to see it happen again. Not what happened to...
My voice broke. To my people. To my parents. The room was so hot, but my hands felt cold. My vision blurred. I couldn't stay here anymore. I had to get out.
Thank you, I said.
And I stood, my neck bent to avoid hitting my head on the ceiling, then moved in a crouch down the aisle and got down on my hands and knees to crawl through the double doors out of the chamber. The cool air hit my face, and I squinted against the bright sunlight. I turned toward the beach, careful not to step on anyone or anything, and ran away as quickly as I dared. Chapter 9. I made it almost to the water before FM caught up to me. My calves burned from moving so quickly across the sand, though I'd been out of breath since before I left the Senate.
Jorgen, she said.
I didn't turn around.
Jorgen!
She caught me by the shoulder, spinning me around. My thoughts raced, and I felt like I could just keep spinning. What the scud had I just done? I'd shot a bunch of mind blades at a group of politicians. I'd sat in so many of those kinds of meetings growing up. I knew how to behave, how to hold everything in, how to present a calm front, no matter what was going on inside. Why did I have to go and do that?
Jorgen, FM said, this has to stop.
She was right, though I wasn't sure which this she meant. The part where I faked being in control, though I didn't have any idea what I was doing. This charade where we pretended we could put together alliances and fight the superiority. Even if these people did agree to join us, what did we have to offer them? Was there any victory over an enemy this powerful? The best we could say was that so far, we hadn't been exterminated completely. Though until very recently, I didn't think the superiority had really been trying.
Say something, FM said.
I didn't see Alanique behind her. I wondered if she'd gone to tell the others what happened, or stayed to try to reason with the Kitson some more. She couldn't possibly do a worse job than I'd done. I swore, scrubbing my hands over my face.
Okay, FM said. That's a good start.
I wanted to order her to go away again. I wanted to tell her I had no desire to talk about it. But I also didn't. I was drowning, and I'd brought my whole flight with me, and a large wave crashed onto the sand, and I jumped.
Scud, Jorgen, FM said. Sit down.
That was the only thing I thought myself capable of, so I did. FM sat next to me and set Boomslug and Snuggles into the sand next to her. I messed that up, I said. Stars, I was the flight leader. I wasn't supposed to admit weakness. If I had to, I was supposed to go to my superior officer so my flight wouldn't lose respect for me. But FM had lost respect for me a long time ago, so I guessed there wasn't much to lose.
Actually, FM said, I think what you said improved the meeting. I mean, I wouldn't have suggested that you start throwing around random cytonic powers.
I didn't do that on purpose, I said.
I know. But you got their attention, and then you gave them the speech they needed. And now they're going to have to make a decision. And if they choose to side with the superiority,
she sighed.
Sometimes people are going to make bad choices, and there's nothing we can do about it.
That sucks, I said.
It's the worst, FM said.
But it's not your fault.
It's good.
We're talking about my parents now, I said.
Yes, we're talking about your parents, FM said. And don't even try to order me not to, because I'm not going to listen to you this time. You are holding everything in so tightly that it literally exploded. We are doing this now, whether you like it or not.
I expected to feel angry, but instead I felt relief. Like I'd been holding up something very heavy, and someone else finally saw through my assurances that I had it and took some of the weight. That didn't make any sense, though. Talking about it isn't going to change anything, I said. Nothing can change it.
That's true, FM said. And trust me, I don't like talking about these things any more than you do. But it helps, I promise. It doesn't change what happened, but it changes you.
I looked over at her. You know this from experience?
FM nodded. Rig taught me that. Sometimes he has to make me talk, but every time I'm glad I did.
You guys are really good together, I said. I would never have guessed it before they got together, but they seemed to balance each other out. FM smiled.
Rig is my safe place, she said. But we're not talking about me. We're talking about you, and the fact that you need to talk or you're going to explode. Again.
I ran my hands through the sand. The grains were so tiny, and some of them stuck to my fingers. I don't even know what to say, I said.
Okay, FM said. I'll go first. I was terrified when that superiority ship exploded. I thought you had died in there. That's the second time in a couple of weeks that we all thought you died, and it was horrible both times. So I would appreciate it if you'd stop doing that.
I hadn't thought about what that was like for the flight, waiting in their ships. They'd known there was a bomb. Alanik had pulled Rig in to try to disarm it. Oh, Scud, is Rig okay? I asked. He knows that it wasn't his fault, right? FM held out a hand and wobbled it back and forth.
I mean, logically, he knows. He is not an expert at diffusing explosives, but he still blames himself.
I should have said something to him. I was the officer in charge of that operation, and it was my responsibility to.
We're not talking about Rig either, FM said. The question is, do you blame yourself?
Yes, I said. I didn't even have to think about it.
But you know it isn't your fault, right?
I stared out at the ocean. The sun was starting to get lower in the sky, the light over the whole landscape turning an orangey yellow. I didn't answer, and FM sighed.
What happened on the ship? Before the explosion?
I closed my eyes. My memories felt fractured, slowed down and sped up all at once. We split up, I said. I was taking fake Cobb to my parents to out him. Alanik went to release Gran Gran. She was able to communicate with Gran Gran, and Gran Gran said she could sense Cobb, like, cytonically, even though she shouldn't have been able to do that.
So something strange was going on with Gran Gran even before they hyperjumped, FM said.
Yeah, I guess so. Alanik also said Gran Gran was talking about hearing voices. Voices asking for help. Oh, Scud. Whatever had gone wrong with her, was it happening to me too? She'd somehow lost her powers because of it, and if I did the same.
There's more, I said. Those people in the tent are Gran Gran and Cobb, at least, best as we can tell, but Gran Gran doesn't appear to be cytonic.
What does that mean? FM asked.
It means her mind isn't.
visible to us in the nowhere anymore. She's lost her vibration, I guess.
I'll take your word for it, FM said. That's bad, Jorgen.
Yeah, I said. She was fleeing a superiority ship. Maybe it was a trap they left for anyone trying to hyperjump away. But Alanik and I didn't get caught in it. Not yet, anyway. I remembered the strange things I'd felt when Alanik and I were looking for Gran-Gran and Cobb in the nowhere. The texture, like there were hundreds of beings around me, there one moment and gone the next. There was something out there in the nowhere. Maybe it wasn't the superiority at all. I wonder if it's them, I said. The Delvers. The voices didn't sound like I would imagine a Delver.
Wait, FM said. You've heard them? The voices that asked for help?
Scud. Yeah, I said, rubbing my hands on my knees, trying to wipe off the sand. The stuff seemed to cling to everything. I wondered if we'd ever be free of it. I heard them in the meeting, right before I... Right before.
That's not good, FM said. There's something really weird going on, and you're all caught up in it.
I know, I said.
And that's the only reason I've let us get sidetracked for this long. You were telling me about what happened on the ship. You told me all about what happened to Alanik.
I went to find my parents, I said. It took me a while, because the ship was big and I took some wrong turns. Eventually, fake Cobb got away from me and ran off. He seemed really eager to get out of there, though I didn't know why until Alanik told me about the bomb.
Right,
FM said. By the time I found my parents, they were trapped in this room in the center of the ship. I could see them through the glass, but it wouldn't break, and all the doors were sealed shut. I saw my father's face through the glass, his resignation when the superiority announced they were going to be exterminated. My mother yelling at me to leave them, to escape, to save myself. The superiority announced they were going to kill them, I said. Alanik and I tried to find a way to get them out, but there wasn't one.
That's not your fault, FM said. You had minutes at best, like Rig. You weren't prepared for that, and it isn't your fault. The superiority did this, not you.
My mother told me to go, but I didn't. I wouldn't listen to Alanik either. And right before Alanik pulled me out, my mother spoke to me through the glass. She said to do better than they did.
Stars, FM said. No wonder you feel pressure to stay in control of everything.
I didn't want to be in control. I just wanted to make sure the DDF was in the hands of someone who would keep our people safe. I didn't want to leave them, I said. If Alanik hadn't pulled me out, I would have died there. FM closed her eyes.
Thank the stars for Alanik, then.
I couldn't say this next part. I couldn't bring myself to form the words, especially not to FM. Maybe it would have been easier if I had died there. I looked out over the ocean. I couldn't think like that. My flight needed me. Cobb needed me. We had to figure out how to reverse whatever the superiority or the Delvers had done to him and get him back in charge of the DDF. FM was right. My parents' deaths weren't my fault. But all the ways I was failing everyone now, falling apart when I should have been leading, that was squarely on my head. I stood up and brushed sand off my flight suit.
You aren't done talking, FM said.
Yes, I said, I am. I couldn't sit here being useless. Maybe FM was right. Maybe talking could change how I felt, but it didn't do anything to help everyone else. I couldn't indulge in that. I couldn't be useless. I'd already lost Spencer, lost my parents. I couldn't let it happen again, not to anyone else.
Maybe for now, FM said. We'll talk more later.
Scud, I'd answered her questions. Wasn't that enough? I was almost glad to see Alanik headed my way with Ned and Arturo. Juno floated along farther behind them. I didn't want to answer their questions either, but at least they weren't going to probe me about my feelings, especially in front of the kitchen.
Dude, Ned said when they drew near. Did you seriously explode?
Shut up, Ned, Arturo said.
But did you?
I already told you what happened, Alanique said, looking annoyed. You didn't believe me?
We believe you, Ned said. We're just incredulous.
That word literally means unable to believe, Alanique said. Is there a translation error, or are you making fun of me?
Neither, FM said. They're just idiots.
Yeah, it's true, I said.
That they're idiots? Alanique asked.
Sometimes, I said. But I did explode.
That is awesome, Ned said.
I mean, not the part where you threw around deadly mind weapons at a political summit. That seems bad. Bad didn't begin to cover it, but there was also something off about it. Juno finally caught up to us, which was good because I wanted his opinion on this. Why didn't I hurt anyone? I asked. When I startled Boomslug, he cut me up.
Your mind blades are ill-formed, Juno said. You need training to make them sharper, stronger.
I don't want them to be sharper, I said. I could have killed somebody. I waited for one of them to tell me I was being overdramatic. They didn't.
When Kaori said you wanted to learn about the Shadow Walkers, Juno said, she didn't tell me you were one. I have spent my life studying their texts, their lore, their ancient wisdom. You have strength, but you need control, and I can teach you if you will consent to be taught.
What about your Senate? I asked. Will they allow it?
The Senate has taken a recess, Alanique said. They want to think about the things you said, and then they're going to convene in the morning to make a decision. In the meantime, they say we're free to transport Cobb and Gran Gran home to Detritus.
Okay, I said. We need to take care of that first.
I can handle the transport, Alanique said. You can go with Juno, as long as you promise to fill me in on what you've learned later.
Okay, I said. You hyperjump Gran Gran and Cobb to Platform Prime with the medical crew. Hopefully Cobb and Gran Gran would recover faster with our medical resources at home. Then they could tell us what had happened to Gran Gran's powers. I turned to Arturo and Ned. You two help her get them there safely.
Of course, Arturo said. We've got this.
And they all headed toward the hospital tent.
I'll go check on the others, FM said, and see what kind of accommodations we can find for the night. We may have to sleep in our starships, but I guess Spencer did that for most of flight school, so it can't be too bad.
She walked away, leaving me alone on the beach with Juno, who hovered up until he was at eye level with me.
I have studied mind blades all my life, Juno said, but I had never seen them before today. Tell me, human, what you did. Was it a stunt? A display of power? Were you trying to intimidate them?
No, I said. I just lost control.
If I may ask, Juno said, control of what?
I blinked at him. Of myself, I said. Of this unstoppable, unknowable force that wanted to rip its way out of me. I'd been taught all my life to feel shame for the defect, never to speak of it. I'd spent so long wishing I could keep up with Spencer, with Alanique, wishing I wasn't so hopeless at using my powers, wishing I could harness them to protect the people I loved. But somehow I'd still never made this connection. I was dangerous. I want to learn how to control them, I said.
Good, then, Juno said. Come with me, and we'll see what we can do.
Chapter 10.
Breathe in, breathe out, Juno said. You are now completely relaxed.
I was far from completely relaxed. I sat cross-legged on top of the cliff above Dreamspring while Juno hovered on his platform in front of me, reading from a book that he said contained the ancient exercises used by Kitsune Cytonics. He changed into a set of power armor that covered every part of him except his ears, his eyes, and his nose. The terrain up here was rough and rocky, the orange stone warm beneath me. We'd chosen this location because the tops of the cliffs were unpopulated. If I managed to produce a mind blade, there was no one around to be hurt by it but Juno, and he swore it was his sacred responsibility to put himself into the line of fire. I didn't know how much his armor would help against a mind blade, but he'd insisted on wearing it anyway. And it did look badass, I'd give him that. I thought this was supposed to focus on mind blades, I said, not breathing.
Patience, Juno said. According to the wisdom of the ancients, in order to achieve control, you must first accept that you have none by bringing yourself into alignment with the will of the universe.
I can't both achieve control and have none. That's ridiculous.
It is the way of the Shadow Walkers, Juno said. It is the way the ancients channeled their power, and the way that you must channel yours.
I sighed, interrupting the continuous breathing that Juno insisted I try. That didn't make sense to me either. I was pretty sure every creature with lungs used continuous breathing to stay alive. So why was that something I needed to practice? Spensa had figured out how to hyperjump, and Alanique could do it with ease, and I was pretty sure extra continuous breathing had not been involved. Then again, it wasn't any more ridiculous than kneading bread while wearing a blindfold, and that had been oddly helpful. It changes you, FM had said. I still wasn't sure I'd done a great job of talking, but maybe I could be better at this. Breathing was easy, so what did I have to complain about?
Let's begin again, Juno said. Close your eyes.
And instead of telling him this was a waste of my time, I did.
See yourself walking along a beach, Juno said. With each breath, the waves wash in and the waves wash out.
Less than a day ago, I would have had no idea what Juno was talking about. But now I could picture myself on the beach. I could practically hear the churning of the ocean, the strangely mechanical white noise produced by so much water moving at once.
Feel the wind on your skin, Juno said. The heat of the sun as it burns down from above. Hear the sounds of the waves as they lap upon the shore. Smell the salt in the air and the rotting of the seaweed washed up on the beach as it slowly decays.
That's disgusting, I said.
Yes, Juno said, but it is the method of the ancients, and you're not supposed to speak during the exercise.
Sorry, I said.
You walk forward and stand in the ocean. Feel the water as it washes against your feet. The temperature is pleasant, not too warm and not too cool.
If Spensa were listening to this, she would embellish on it. I laughed.
Is something funny?
No, I said. Just imagining the ocean running red with the blood of my enemies. Juno sounded startled.
Is that some kind of cytonic premonition?
Nope, I said. A memory of my girlfriend. Never mind, go on.
The waves wash against your legs once, twice, three times. Feel the pull of the ocean current as it tugs on your feet. Your mind is the ocean, flowing from this realm to the next, drawing close and then away again. Let your mind slip outward like the tide, into the vast ocean of nothingness that surrounds you.
Scud. My mind did slip into the nowhere as easily as he said. In and out like the tide. The longer I pictured it, the easier it was to do. I didn't want to be in the nowhere. That was where the voices came from, and that strange texture, a presence that felt like so many beings all crowding in on me. Either or both could be the eyes, but they felt different, not as menacing, friendly, even.
As the wave of your mind washes into this dimension, it carries with it a bit of the nowhere. Shards of nothing ride atop the wave, washing into the somewhere, each of them becoming
only for a moment, then fading away.
I could feel them, the fragments of nowhere, the little bits of nothing following my mind into the somewhere. They had to take form. Everything in this world had form, while that world was the absence of it. A presence pressed in on my mind. Alanique, working with the medtechs to transport Cobb and Grangran. She might return with orders from Stoff calling us back to Detritus, so I needed to concentrate and learn while I still could.
Observe the fragments as they emerge. Notice their shape and their texture. Draw them forth from your memory.
The fragments did have a shape. My mind skipped over the nowhere like a stone on a pond, and each time it made contact, the fragments of nothing broke off. They were shaped like crystals, oblong with crisp, faceted sides. I couldn't hold them so much as glimpse them.
Picture their shapes in your mind and begin to mold them. Will them to alter their form little by little, growing sharper, larger, stronger. The fragments are you, and you are the fragments. They bend to your will, as you bend your will to the vibrations of the universe.
I didn't know what it meant that I was the fragments, but I focused on them, trying to change their shape. And they did change, as if they weren't bits of nothing at all, but pieces of my mind, energy that was scattering and dissipating while I made contact with the nowhere. My whole body tensed as the fragments got sharper.
When you are ready, bring your mind into alignment with them. Feel their rhythm. Align your vibration to theirs. You are them, and they are you. You are as one, neither exerting control over the other, of one mind, one will, and one spirit.
What am I supposed to do? I said. Juno cleared his throat.
Do you want me to read it again?
Okay. Though I wasn't sure I was going to understand it any better the second time.
I will admit, when I imagined having the opportunity to guide the meditations of a shadow walker, I had not envisioned quite so many interruptions.
Sorry, I said. As Juno read, I tried to focus on the vibration of the fragments. Were they really my own mind, flying out of the nowhere? I worried about what they might do if I tried to move them, especially since I didn't have any idea how to align my will with them. But I needed to try. I touched the fragments lightly and... oh. I opened my eyes, sensing a fragment flying off over the cliff, cutting through the breeze before it dissipated. I think I did it, I said. The sky above us was turning a deep shade of indigo, but over the water it was a bright yellow, which faded into orange and then pink. A sunset. I'd seen paintings of those, but they'd failed to capture the beauty. And here I had been keeping my eyes closed. I hoped the rest of my flight was watching it at least.
We came up here because you would not harm anything if you succeeded in manifesting the blades, Juno said. Now I see the folly in it. We cannot tell if you've manifested them, because there is nothing for you to manipulate but me.
That wasn't entirely true. Hang on, I said, and I turned around. Scud, now I was facing away from the sunset. But if this worked, it would be worth it. Read to me again, I said, the part about the continuous breathing. Juno started the meditation over, and I closed my eyes and tried to focus on my surroundings, to skim the surface of the nowhere with my mind, until I could feel the fragments appearing and scattering. I focused on them, molding them into tiny points, like blades of grass I'd seen in paintings of old Earth. I reached out, touching the fragments lightly with my mind. And then I pushed them down, shoving them out away from my feet. A sound, like marbles hitting sandstone. I opened my eyes. Scud. I'd scratched the stone in front of me, leaving gouges in it.
Shadow Walker, Juno said. It seems the meditation has worked.
It seemed it had. Let me try that again, I said. Juno read to me from his meditations, and each time I aimed with the strange shards of nowhere, the grooves in the sandstone grew deeper, until I was cutting deep gashes no wider than my index finger. "Do you have more of those meditations in your books?" I asked.
"Many more," Juno said. "Entire volumes, in fact."
If Stoff decided to pull us home, maybe I could use that knowledge as an excuse to stay. At least, until Alanik and I could learn more about how to use our powers. We were the best weapons the DDF had right now, but we needed more training, a lot more. "Thank you, Juno," I said.
"It has been my pleasure, Shadow Walker."
It was strange for him to call me that, since I didn't walk anywhere. I wondered if he had a meditation in his book that could teach me to hyperjump. "Let's try it again," I said, walking over to a fresh section of the cliff. "I want to see how deep I can make the shards." I slipped into the nowhere, and immediately a voice entered my mind.
"We hear you," it said.
Scud, was that the Delvers? It didn't feel terrifying, but
"Help us," it said. "We hear you."
They didn't sound menacing. They sounded desperate, scared. "I don't know how to help you," I said.
"Is something wrong?" Juno asked.
"I can hear someone," I said. "Someone asking for my help."
"Jorgen,"
a voice said. I recognized that one. Gran-Gran, was she awake now? "You have your powers back?"
"I, what?"
"Your powers," I said. "Are you awake? Did they disappear while you were asleep somehow?"
"Not a lot of time," Gran-Gran said. "Hard to concentrate, but you need to help us."
Her voice faded, and while I called her name again into the nowhere, she didn't respond.
"Jorgen," Alanik said, "we need you at the medical tent. You need to see this."
She sounded urgent, so I didn't ask questions. "Excuse me," I said to Juno. "I want to learn more, but my people need me."
"Of course," Juno said.
I called to Snuggles, who was waiting again in my ship. She appeared in my arms. "Take me to Alanik," I said, sending Snuggles a picture.
"Alanik,"
Snuggles said. Juno, the cliff, and the melting remains of the sunset all disappeared. Chapter 11. Snuggles and I passed by the eyes and jumped to the front of the medical tent, where the medtechs had loaded Cobb and Gran-Gran onto stretchers. Ned and Arturo each stood at the foot of one of the stretchers, with Kel and Winnow at the heads. I sent Snuggles immediately back to Boomslug in my ship. "What's wrong?" I asked Alanik.
"We started moving them over to the ship," Winnow said, indicating to where the transport shuttle was waiting down by the water. "But as we took them farther from the tent, they started to deteriorate."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"Blood pressure dropped," Kel said. "Heart rates became irregular. What's strange is that it happened to both of them at more or less the same time."
"Why would that happen?" I asked.
"I can't explain it," Kel said. "Even weirder is they stabilized as soon as we brought them back here."
"It's like they don't want to be away from here," Winnow said. "We wanted to load them in the ship first so we wouldn't jostle them when we hyperjump."
"If their condition is linked to this place, then we definitely can't hyperjump them," I said. "But why would it matter if they're here?"
"Your guess is as good as mine," Winnow said. "But my professional judgment is that we don't move a patient if moving changes their condition for the worse."
"Can you treat them here?" Winnow nodded.
"We may need to go home for some equipment, but for the moment, we can get them comfortable."
"Thank you," I said. Arturo stepped up beside me.
"What do you think is going on?" he asked.
"I don't know," I said. I slipped into the nowhere, listening, but the only cytonic I felt nearby was Alanik. Gran-Gran's powers still seemed to be gone, but I heard her in the nowhere.
"Really?"
Alanik asked. "Yeah, hang on. Let me." I focused, returning to the imaginary ocean from the meditation. Instead of focusing on the fragments, which I now realized splintered off every time I touched the nowhere, I listened, trying to hear her again.
Gran-Gran?
No response. I tried to push farther, listening closer. And then I felt the texture again, the strange sensation of bumps, hundreds of them, maybe thousands, all over and around the island. 1 minute, Alanik and I were alone, and then there were so many of them. What were those? I shook myself, dropping my link to the nowhere.
Do you feel that?
I asked Alanik. Those weird ridges?
No, Alanik said. And I don't hear Gran-Gran either. You're sure it was her?
I was sure. If this Gran-Gran didn't have powers, but another Gran-Gran was talking to me from the nowhere, did that mean she was lost in there like Spensa somehow? I'd assumed Spensa's body had gone with her when she left, but I hadn't asked, and maybe she wouldn't even know. Juno had finally caught up to me, his disc floating toward us from the cliff face. Juno, I called to him. Do you know anything about shadow walkers projecting their spirits into the nowhere without their bodies?
The soul is made up of the body and the mind, Juno said. Your mind enters the nowhere whenever you interact with it. Only when you hyperjump does your body follow.
Sure, I said. But can the mind end up stuck in the nowhere without the body to follow it?
I have not read of it happening, Juno said. Not in all the books of lore.
It wouldn't explain this anyway, Alanik said. When your mind goes into the negative realm, your body remains and continues to resonate cytonically. Otherwise, we would stop being able to sense each other every time we communicated through the negative realm. Why would your body stop resonating if your mind was stuck?
I don't know, I said. But I wonder if it has something to do with the voices Gran-Gran was hearing before she hyperjumped. The voices I was hearing now. Scud, I did not want to end up in a mysterious coma. Something went wrong in the jump, and it's still possible that she's stuck somehow. Though I didn't know why she would have stopped talking to me. She said it was difficult somehow. Juno, I said, can you show me where Cobb and Gran-Gran first came through the nowhere?
Of course, Juno said. They were found in the burrow that once belonged to our master shadow walkers. Now it is our library, the home of our lore.
In a library? That seemed unhelpful, but still. I'd like to see it, I said. Alanik, will you come with us?
Of course, Alanik said.
She seemed confused about why I'd want to see it, but she didn't argue.
FM said we're camping on the beach tonight, Ned said, because there are no kits in buildings big enough to hold all of us. We'll go see about setting up camp.
The sky was rapidly growing dark now that the last sliver of the sun had finished setting. The horizon over the ocean had turned a rosy shade of pink, but over the cliffs I could make out the first of the stars. Thank you, I said to Ned, and I followed Juno as he led Alanik and me toward the library. Unlike the elevated burrows of the rest of Dreamspring, the library was set down in a kind of crater, deep beneath the sandstone cliff. We descended a set of tiny stairs, and Alanik and I pressed our hands against the sandstone walls, resting our feet on three or four steps at a time, using them more for traction than as stairs. As we moved, I felt that cytonic resonance I detected earlier growing stronger. We were heading toward something important. We descended far enough down that if the waves were to lap this far, they'd surely fill the basin. But they must not ever reach this part of the island if the library had remained intact for so long. We had to crawl through the ornate, arched doorway after Juno, but the library itself was several levels tall, which allowed Alanik and me to stand with a meter of headroom to spare. The room was filled with tables barely above ankle height, and I was careful where I stepped, so as not to disturb any of the cushions set around them or the carts covered in books and scrolls. Along three of the walls were shelves covered in books, all of them smaller than the palm of my hand. Ladders scaled the walls, which were lined with railed walkways for perusing the rows of shelves, though several of the acclivity stone platforms also waited at the entrance of the room to provide ease of access. It was the fourth wall, though, that caught my attention. It was a stone wall, smooth and polished, with rows and rows of lines carved into it in a strange, almost technological design. The wall radiated a power that was undeniably cytonic, and something about it felt familiar. "This is where you found them?" I asked Juno. "Yes," Juno said, hovering in the doorway on his platform. "Over there, by the scroll case. They appeared lying side by side on top of some tables." Alenique picked her way across the room and examined the wall, which stretched all the way to the relatively high ceiling. She pressed her hand to the lines on the wall.
"I've never seen anything like this," she said.
Neither had I, but I swore I'd heard of a wall like this. Oh, scud. Now I remembered where. "Alenique, step away from the wall," I said. She looked over her shoulder at me like I was crazy, but she did as I asked, working her way past the rows of tables littered with books.
"What is it?"
she asked. I think it's a portal," I said, "an entrance to the nowhere. Spensa told me there's one in the caverns of Detritus. She said we should search for it, but that we needed to be careful, because a cytonic could fall through and get stuck there like she did. We had teams looking for it, but I hadn't heard if they'd found anything." Alenique suddenly looked alarmed.
"What does that mean?" she asked. "If Gran-Gran hyperjumped, she shouldn't have had to use a physical portal. There wasn't one like this on the Superiority ship."
"I don't know what it means," I said. "But Gran-Gran heard voices asking for help before she jumped, right? And I've been hearing them too." Alenique squinted at me.
"Voices from the negative realm?"
"Maybe," I said. I concentrated, listening for them again. "Juno, you said this used to be the burrow where your master cytonics lived. What happened to them?"
"They met in a great summit to compile the vast knowledge of our people," Juno said. "During the summit, they simply disappeared, leaving behind only these strange symbols."
He gestured to the wall.
"Beyond that, we don't know, as there was no one left to write down the history."
"There wouldn't be if they all disappeared at once. My people had lost knowledge the same way. After the crash of the Defiant Fleet, the first lifebuster bomb dropped by the Superiority had killed all the officers, the entire command staff, everyone who knew what had happened and why. We were left to make up our own stories about the Krell. Thanks to Spensa, though, I had a hunch as to what might have happened. They left this wall behind," I said. "Because the summit was here? In this room?"
"Yes," Juno said. "This city has been our capital for centuries, so it was a natural meeting place."
"If they decided to try out their knowledge," I said, "they might have figured out how to create this portal into the nowhere and then gotten trapped inside."
"If that is so," Juno said, "I'm afraid they should have died many years ago."
That was true, but I'd heard something in the nowhere. I focused on the portal. I couldn't hear the voices at the moment, not Gran-Gran's or the others. They were asking for help. Gran-Gran had heard them. She'd spent so many years trapped on Detritus, listening to the stars. If anyone could have honed their skills at detecting signals in the nowhere no one else could hear, it was her.
"Did Spensa tell you how to open it?" Alenique asked.
"No," I said. "And I haven't been able to reach her again these last few days, so I can't ask." I turned to Juno. "Are there legends of what happened to the cytonics? If there was any truth in them, there might be some clue as to how to reach the Kitson cytonics, and Gran-Gran, who had been lost chasing after them."
"Oh, many," Juno said. "Most of them are children's tales. My favorite involves a band of space pirates who flew through the skies on the back of an enormous turtle."
space pirates stole your cytonics?
Almost certainly not, Juno said. I said it was my favorite, not the most accurate.
Which would you say is the most accurate? I asked.
It's impossible to say for certain, of course, Juno said. But I've always given credence to the theories of Ito, who wrote that...
Jorgen! Arturo's voice came from the handheld radio clipped to my belt. Yes, I responded.
Superiority carrier ship, Arturo said. There are fighters headed this way.
Scud. The superiority. I'd hoped they hadn't heard Kaori's signal and didn't realize we were here. Apparently I was wrong. We have to go, I told Alanique.
If you are going to use your new skills against the enemy, Juno said, perhaps I could accompany you.
I didn't know if I was ready for that, but a Kitsun wouldn't take up much space in my cockpit, even less than the slugs, though I hoped he didn't want to cuddle as close. Okay, I said. I called Snuggles, and she appeared instantly on my shoulder with Boomslug in tow, because she couldn't seem to go anywhere without him anymore. I put one hand on Alanique's shoulder and one on Juno's platform and asked Snuggles to hyperjump us all to the beach. Chapter 12. The carrier ship loomed in the sky above Dreamspring, illuminated by the ivory-colored moon peeking over the horizon. The ship sat directly above the city, ringed by puffs of clouds. It looked out of place over the idyllic landscape.
They are here for you, Juno asked.
He didn't sound like he blamed us. He was simply gathering the facts. Probably, I said. We'd brought this down on the Kitsun. It was our responsibility to do what we could to protect them. I didn't have to give the order for my flight to get to their ships. They were already running. I kept my hands on Alanique's shoulder and Juno's platform and directed Snuggles to hyperjump us to FM's fighter. We need to release the Tanix, I said. We might need them to retrieve the others. I raised FM's canopy and released Gil, and then Alanique and I raced between the ships, opening the boxes. When we finished, I had Snuggles hyperjump Juno and me straight to my cockpit. Alanique ran for her ship, while Juno took up position right behind my seat. We lifted off as four enemy ships swooped in overhead. The rest of the flight were still running. We needed to provide air support, or they were going to get gunned down before they got into the air. Cover me, I said to Alanique.
Got it, Alanique responded.
I flew straight at the enemy ships, opening fire so they had to scatter or lose their shields. Juno gave a little squeak of surprise, like he hadn't expected the fighter to, what, fight? Alanique got a few good shots on the ships as they rolled, and then followed on my wing as I pursued the ships long enough to draw their fire and lead them out over the ocean away from the beach.
Well, that was exciting, Juno said.
He seemed to have affixed the boots of his power armor to his hovering disc so he wouldn't go flying off as I accelerated.
You haven't seen anything.
Circle around and cover the others, I told Alanique, and she peeled away and shot at one of the enemy ships, which had also turned back. For all Alanique's talk about proving yourself in combat, she fit effortlessly into the flight and never argued when I gave her orders.
Jerk face, Arturo said over the radio. The others are getting in their ships now, but Quirk and Sentry are pinned down over by where we had that feast.
Got it, I said. Angel, cover the others until they get in their ships, then back me up. I darted off down the beach, immediately spotting the ship Arturo was talking about. It was peppering the rock with destructor fire, and I hoped Kimmelin and Sadie had found good cover. I opened fire, getting in one good hit before the ship went into a bank, then rolled and returned fire. I flew beneath the ship, forcing it to turn.